Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, From Different Seasons, by Stephen King. Narrated by Frank Muller. In Different Seasons, Stephen King has written four novellas, one for each season of the year. This one is subtitled Hope Springs Eternal. And now, Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption.
There's a guy like me in every state and federal prison in America, I guess. I'm the guy who can get it for you. Tailor-made cigarettes, bag of reefer, if you're partial to that, bottle of brandy to celebrate your son or daughter's high school graduation, or almost anything else. Within reason, that is. It wasn't always that way. I came to Shawshank when I was just 20, and I am one of the few people in our happy little family willing to own up to what they did. I committed murder. I put a large insurance policy on my wife, who was 3 years older than I was, and then I fixed the brakes of the Chevrolet coupe her father had given us as a wedding present. It worked out exactly as I had planned. Except I hadn't planned on her stopping to pick up the neighbor woman and the neighbor woman's infant son on their way down Castle Hill and into town. The brakes let go, and the car crashed through the bushes at the edge of the town common, gathering speed. Bystanders said it must have been doing 50 or better when it hit the base of the Civil War statue and burst into flames. I also hadn't planned on getting caught, but caught I was. I got a season's pass into this place. Maine has no death penalty, but the district attorney saw to it that I was tried for all three deaths and given three life sentences to run one after the other. That fixed up any chance of parole I might have for a long, long time. The judge called what I had done a hideous, heinous crime. And it was, but it is also in the past now. You can look it up in the yellowing files of the Castle Rock Call, where the big headlines announcing my conviction look sort of funny and antique next to the news of Hitler and Mussolini and FDR's alphabet soup agencies. Have I rehabilitated myself, you ask? I don't even know what that word means. At least as far as prisons and corrections go. I think it's a politician's word. It may have some other meaning, and it may be that I will have a chance to find out, but that is the future, something cons teach themselves not to think about. I was young, good-looking, and from the poor side of town. I knocked up a pretty, sulky, headstrong girl who lived in one of the fine old houses on Carbine Street. Her father was agreeable to the marriage, if I would take a job in the optical company he owned and work my way up. I found out that what he really had in mind was keeping me in his house and under his thumb, like a disagreeable pet that has not quite been housebroken and which may bite. Enough hate eventually piled up to cause me to do what I did. Given a second chance, I would not do it again, but I'm not sure that means I am rehabilitated. Anyway, it's not me I want to tell you about. I want to tell you about a guy named Andy Dufresne, but before I can tell you about Andy, I have to explain a few other things about myself. It won't take long. As I said, I've been the guy who can get it for you here at Shawshank for damn near 40 years. And that doesn't just mean contraband items like extra cigarettes or booze, although those items always top the list. But I've gotten thousands of other items for men doing time here, some of them perfectly legal, yet hard to come by in a place where you've supposedly been brought to be punished. There was one fellow who was in for raping a little girl and exposing himself to dozens of others. I got him 3 pieces of pink Vermont marble, and he did 3 lovely sculptures out of them. A baby, a boy of about 12, and a bearded young man. He called them the 3 ages of Jesus. And those pieces of sculpture are now in the parlor of a man who used to be governor of this state. Or here's a name you may remember if you grew up north of Massachusetts, Robert Allen Coate. In 1951, he tried to rob the First Mercantile Bank of Mechanic Falls, and the holdup turned into a bloodbath, 6 dead in the end, 2 of them members of the gang, 3 of them hostages, 1 of them a young state cop who put his head up at the wrong time and got a bullet in the eye. Coate had a penny collection. Naturally, they weren't going to let him have it in here, but with a little help from his mother and a middleman who used to drive a laundry truck, I was able to get it for him. I told him, "Bobby, you must be crazy wanting to have a coin collection in a stone hotel full of thieves." He looked at me and smiled and said, "I know where to keep 'em. They'll be safe enough, don't you worry." And he was right. Bobby Coate died of a brain tumor in 1967, but that coin collection has never turned up. I've gotten men chocolates on Valentine's Day. I got 3 of those green milkshakes they serve at McDonald's around St. Paddy's Day for a crazy Irishman named O'Malley. I even arranged for a midnight showing of Deep Throat and The Devil in Miss Jones for a party of 20 men who had pooled their resources to rent the films. Although I ended up doing a week in solitary for that little escapade, it's the risk you run when you're the guy who can get it. I've gotten reference books and fuck books, joke novelties like hand buzzers and itching powder, and on more than one occasion I've seen that a long-timer has gotten a pair of panties from his wife or his girlfriend. And I guess you'll know what guys in here do with such items during the long nights, when time draws out like a blade. I don't get all those things gratis, and for some items the price comes high. But I don't do it just for the money. What good is money to me? I'm never going to own a Cadillac car or fly off to Jamaica for 2 weeks in February. I do it for the same reason that a good butcher will only sell you fresh meat. I got a reputation and I want to keep it. The only 2 things I refuse to handle are guns and heavy drugs. I won't help anyone kill himself or anyone else. I have enough killing on my mind to last me a lifetime. Yeah, I'm a regular Neiman Marcus. And so when Andy Dufresne came to me in 1949 and asked if I could smuggle Rita Hayworth into the prison for him, I said it would be no problem at all. And it wasn't. When Andy came to Shawshank in 1948, he was 30 years old. He was a short, neat little man with sandy hair and small, clever hands. He wore gold-rimmed spectacles. His fingernails were always clipped, and they were always clean. That's a funny thing to remember about a man, I suppose, but it seems to sum Andy up for me. He always looked as if he should have been wearing a tie. On the outside, he had been a vice president in the trust department of a large Portland bank. Good work for a man as young as he was, especially when you consider how conservative most banks are. And you have to multiply that conservatism by 10 when you get up into New England, where folks don't like to trust a man with their money unless he's bald, limping, and constantly plucking at his pants to get his truss round straight. Andy was in for murdering his wife and her lover. As I believe I have said, everyone in prison is an innocent man. Oh, they read that scripture the way those holy rollers on TV read the book of Revelation. They were the victims of judges with hearts of stone and balls to match, or incompetent lawyers, or police frame-ups, or bad luck. They read the scripture, but you can see a different scripture in their faces. Most cons are a low sort, no good to themselves or anyone else. And their worst luck was that their mothers carried them to term. In all my years at Shawshank, there have been less than 10 men whom I believed when they told me they were innocent. Andy Dufresne was one of them, although I only became convinced of his innocence over a period of years. If I had been on the jury that heard his case in Portland Superior Court over 6 stormy weeks in 1947 and 48, I would have voted to convict too. It was one hell of a case, all right, one of those juicy ones, with all the right elements. There was a beautiful girl with society connections, dead. A local sports figure, also dead. and a prominent young businessman in the dock. There was this, plus all the scandal the newspapers could hint at. The prosecution had an open and shut case. The trial only lasted as long as it did because the DA was planning to run for the U.S. House of Representatives, and he wanted John Q. Public to get a good long look at his fizz. It was a crackerjack legal circus, with spectators getting in line at 4 a.m, despite the sub-zero temperatures, to assure themselves of a seat. The facts of the prosecution's case that Andy never contested were these: that he had a wife, Linda Collins Dufresne, that in June of 1947 she had expressed an interest in learning the game of golf at the Falmouth Hills Country Club, that she did indeed take lessons for 4 months, that her instructor was the Falmouth Hills golf pro, Glenn Quentin, that in late August of 1947 Andy learned that Quentin and his wife had become lovers, that Andy and Linda Dufresne argued bitterly on the afternoon of September 10th, 1947, that the subject of their argument was her infidelity. He testified that Linda professed to be glad he knew. The sneaking around, she said, was distressing. She told Andy that she planned to obtain a Reno divorce. Andy told her he would see her in hell before he would see her in Reno. She went off to spend the night with Quentin in Quentin's rented bungalow not far from the golf course. The next morning, his cleaning woman found both of them dead in bed. Each had been shot 4 times. It was that last fact that militated more against Andy than any of the others. The DA, with the political aspirations, made a great deal of it in his opening statement and his closing summation. Andrew Dufresne, he said, was not a wronged husband seeking a hot-blooded revenge against his cheating wife. That, the DA said, could be understood if not condoned. But this revenge had been of a much colder type. Consider, the DA thundered at the jury, 4 and 4, not 6 shots, but 8. He had fired the gun empty and then stopped to reload so he could shoot each of them again. 4 for him and 4 for her, the Portland Sun blared. The Boston Register dubbed him the Even Steven Killer. A clerk from the Wise Pawn Shop in Lewiston testified that he had sold a 6-shot .38 police special to Andrew Dufresne just 2 days before the double murder. A bartender from the country club testified that Andy had come in around 7 o'clock on the evening of September 10th, had tossed off 3 straight whiskies in a 20-minute period. When he got up from the bar stool, he told the bartender that he was going up to Glenn Quentin's house, and he, the bartender, could read about the rest of it in the papers. Another clerk, this one from the Handy Pick store a mile or so from Quentin's house, told the court that Dufresne had come in around 8:45 on that same night. He purchased cigarettes, 3 quarts of beer, and some dish towels. The county medical examiner testified that Quentin and the Dufresne woman had been killed between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. on the night of September 10th and 11th. The detective from the Attorney General's office, who had been in charge of the case, testified that there was a turnout less than 70 yards from the bungalow, and that on the afternoon of September 11th, 3 pieces of evidence had been removed from that turnout. First item, 2 empty quart bottles of Narragansett beer with the defendant's fingerprints on them. Second item, 12 cigarette ends, all cool, the defendant's brand. Third item, a plaster moulage of a set of tire tracks exactly matching the tread and wear pattern of the tires on the defendant's 1947 Plymouth. In the living room of Quentin's bungalow, 4 dish towels had been found lying on the sofa. There were bullet holes through them and powder burns on them. The detective theorized, over the agonized objections of Andy's lawyer, that the murderer had wrapped the towels around the muzzle of the murder weapon to muffle the sound of the gunshots. Andy Dufresne took the stand in his own defense and told his story calmly, coolly, and dispassionately. He said he had begun to hear distressing rumors about his wife and Glenn Quentin as early as the last week in July. In late August, he had become distressed enough to investigate a bit. On an evening when Linda was supposed to have gone shopping in Portland after her golf lesson, Andy had followed her and Quentin to Quentin's one-story rented house. Inevitably dubbed the Love Nest by the papers, he had parked in the turnout until Quentin drove her back to the country club where her car was parked about 3 hours later. "Do you mean to tell this court that you followed your wife in your brand-new Plymouth sedan?" the D.A. asked him on cross-examination. "I swapped cars for the evening with a friend," Andy said, and his cool admission of how well-planned his investigation had been did him no good at all in the eyes of the jury. After returning the friend's car and picking up his own, he had gone home. Linda had been in bed, reading a book. He asked her how her trip to Portland had been. She replied that it had been fun, but she hadn't seen anything she liked well enough to buy. "That's when I knew for sure," Andy told the breathless spectators. He spoke in the same calm, remote voice in which he delivered almost all of his testimony. "What was your frame of mind in the 17 days between then and the night your wife was murdered?" Andy's lawyer asked him. "I was in great distress," Andy said calmly, coldly. Like a man reciting a shopping list, he said that he had considered suicide and had even gone so far as to purchase a gun in Lewiston on September 8th. His lawyer then invited him to tell the jury what had happened after his wife left to meet Glenn Quentin on the night of the murders. Andy told them, and the impression he made was the worst possible. "I knew him for close to 30 years, and I can tell you he was the most self-possessed man I've ever known. What was right with him, he'd only give you a little at a time. What was wrong with him, he kept bottled up inside. If he ever had a dark night of the soul, as some writer or other has called it, you would never know. He was the type of man who, if he had decided to commit suicide, would do it without leaving a note, but not until his affairs had been put neatly in order. If he had cried on the witness stand, or if his voice had thickened and grown hesitant, even if he had started yelling at that Washington-bound district attorney, I don't believe he would have gotten the life sentence he wound up with. Even if he had have, he would have been out on parole by 1954, but he told his story like a recording machine, seeming to say to the jury, 'This is it. Take it or leave it.' They left it. He said he was drunk that night, that he'd been more or less drunk since August 24th, and that he was a man who didn't handle his liquor very well. Of course, that by itself would have been hard for any jury to swallow. They just couldn't see this coldly self-possessed young man in the neat double-breasted three-piece woolen suit ever getting falling down drunk over his wife's sleazy little affair with some small-town golf pro. I believed it because I had a chance to watch Andy that those 6 men and 6 women didn't have. Andy Dufresne took just 4 drinks a year, all the time I knew him. He would meet me in the exercise yard every year about a week before his birthday, and then again about 2 weeks before Christmas. On each occasion, he would arrange for a bottle of Jack Daniels. He bought it the way most cons arrange to buy their stuff, the slaves' wages they pay in here, plus a little of his own. Up till 1965, what you got for your time was a dime an hour. In 65, they raised it all the way up to a quarter. My commission on liquor was and is 10%, and when you add on that surcharge to the price of a fine sippin' whiskey like the Black Jack, you get an idea of how many hours of Andy Dufresne's sweat in the prison laundry was going to buy his 4 drinks a year. On the morning of his birthday, September 20th, he would have himself a big knock, and then he'd have another that night after lights out. The following day, he'd give the rest of the bottle back to me, and I would share it around. As for the other bottle, he dealt himself 1 drink Christmas night and another on New Year's Eve. Then that bottle would also come to me with instructions to pass it on. 4 drinks a year. And that is the behavior of a man who has been bitten hard by the bottle, hard enough to draw blood. He told the jury that on the night of the 10th he was so drunk he could only remember what had happened in little isolated snatches. He had gotten drunk that afternoon. I took on a double helping of Dutch courage, is how he put it, before taking on Linda. After she left to meet Quentin, he remembered deciding to confront them. On the way to Quentin's bungalow, he swung into the country club for a couple of quick ones. He could not, he said, remember telling the bartender he could read about the rest of it in the papers, or saying anything to him at all. He remembered buying beer in the handy pick, but not the dish towels. "Why would I want dish towels?" he asked, and one of the papers reported that three of the lady jurors shuddered. Later, much later, he speculated to me about the clerk who had testified on the subject of those dish towels, and I think it's worth jotting down what he said. "Suppose that during their canvass for witnesses," Andy said one day in the exercise yard, "they stumble on this fellow who sold me the beer that night. By then 3 days have gone by. The facts of the case have been broadsided in all the papers. Maybe they ganged up on the guy, 5 or 6 cops, plus the dick from the Attorney General's office, plus the DA's assistant. Memory is a pretty subjective thing, Red. They could have started out with, 'Isn't it possible that he purchased 4 or 5 dish towels,' and worked their way up from there. If enough people want you to remember something, that can be a pretty powerful persuader." I agreed that it could. "But there's one even more powerful," Andy went on in that musing way of his. "I think it's at least possible that he convinced himself. It was the limelight, reporters asking him questions, his picture in the papers, all topped, of course, by his star turn in court. I'm not saying that he deliberately falsified his story or perjured himself. I think it's possible that he could have passed a lie detector test with flying colors, or sworn on his mother's sacred name that I bought those dish towels. But still, memory is such a goddamn subjective thing. I know this much, even though my own lawyer thought I had to be lying about half my story. He never bought that business about the dish towels. It's crazy. On the face of it, I was pig drunk, too drunk to have been thinking about muffling the gunshots. If I'd done it, I would have just let him rip." He went to the turnout and parked there. He drank beer and smoked cigarettes. He watched the lights downstairs in Quentin's place go out. He watched a single light go on upstairs, and 15 minutes later he watched that one go out. He said he could guess the rest. "Mr. Dufresne, did you then go up to Glenn Quentin's house and kill the two of them?" his lawyer thundered. "No, I did not," Andy answered. By midnight he said he was sobering up. He was also feeling the first signs of a bad hangover. He decided to go home and sleep it off and think about the whole thing in a more adult fashion the next day. At that time, as I drove home, I was beginning to think that the wisest course would be to simply let her go to Reno and get her divorce. "Thank you, Mr. Dufresne." The DA popped up. "You divorced her in the quickest way you could think of, didn't you? You divorced her with a .38 revolver wrapped in dish towels, didn't you?" "No, sir, I did not," Andy said calmly. "And then you shot her lover?" "No, sir." "You mean you shot Quentin first?" "I mean I didn't shoot either one of them. I drank 2 quarts of beer and smoked however many cigarettes the police found at the turnout. Then I drove home and went to bed." "You told the jury that between August 24th and September 10th you were feeling suicidal?"
"Yes, sir."
"Suicidal enough to buy a revolver?"
"Yes."
"Would it bother you overmuch, Mr. Dufresne, if I told you that you do not seem to me to be the suicidal type?"
"No," said Andy. "But you don't impress me as being terribly sensitive, and I doubt very much that if I were feeling suicidal I would take my problem to you." There was a slight tense titter in the courtroom at this, but it won him no points with the jury.
"Did you take your .38 with you on the night of September 10th?
"No, as I've already testified."
"Oh, yes," the DA smiled sarcastically. "You threw it into the river, didn't you? The Royal River, on the afternoon of September 9th?
"Yes, sir."
"One day before the murders?"
"Yes, sir."
"That's convenient, isn't it?"
"It's neither convenient nor inconvenient, only the truth."
"I believe you heard Lieutenant Mincher's testimony."
Mincher had been in charge of the party which had dragged the stretch of the Royal near Pond Road Bridge, from which Andy had testified he had thrown the gun. The police had not found it. Yes, sir, you know I heard it. Then you heard him tell the court that they found no gun, although they dragged for 3 days. That was rather convenient, too, wasn't it?
Convenience aside, it's a fact they didn't find the gun, Andy responded calmly. But I should like to point out to both you and the jury that the Pond Road Bridge is very close to where the Royal River empties into the Bay of Yarmouth. The current is strong. The gun may have been carried out into the bay itself. And so no comparison can be made between the riflings on the bullets taken from the blood-stained corpses of your wife and Mr. Glenn Quentin and the riflings on the barrel of your gun. That's correct, isn't it, Mr. Dufresne?
Yes. That's also rather convenient, isn't it?
At that, according to the papers, Andy displayed one of the few slight emotional reactions he allowed himself during the entire 6-week period of the trial. A slight, bitter smile crossed his face.
Since I am innocent of this crime, sir, and since I am telling the truth about throwing my gun into the river the day before the crime took place, then it seems to me decidedly inconvenient that the gun was never found.
The D.A. hammered at him for 2 days. He reread the handy pick clerk's testimony about the dish towels to Andy. Andy repeated that he could not recall buying them, but admitted that he also couldn't remember not buying them. Was it true that Andy and Linda Dufresne had taken out a joint insurance policy in early 1947? Yes, that was true. And if acquitted, wasn't it true that Andy stood to gain $50,000 in benefits? True. And wasn't it true that he had gone up to Glenn Quentin's house with murder in his heart, and wasn't it also true that he had indeed committed murder twice over? No, it was not true. Then what did he think had happened, since there had been no signs of robbery?
I have no way of knowing that, sir, Andy said quietly.
The case went to the jury at 1 o'clock p.m. on a snowy Wednesday afternoon. The 12 jury men and women came back in at 3:30. The bailiff said they would have been back earlier, but they had held off in order to enjoy a nice chicken dinner from Bentley's restaurant at the county's expense. They found him guilty. And, brother, if Maine had the death penalty, he would have done the air dance before that spring's crocuses poked their heads out of the snow. The D.A. had asked him what he thought had happened, and Andy slipped the question. But he did have an idea, and I got it out of him late one evening in 1955. It had taken those 7 years for us to progress from nodding acquaintances to fairly close friends. But I never felt really close to Andy until 1960 or so, and I believe I was the only one who ever did get really close to him. Both being long-timers, we were in the same cell block from beginning to end, although I was halfway down the corridor from him. What do I think? He laughed, but there was no humor in the sound. I think there was a lot of bad luck floating around that night, more than could ever get together in the same short span of time again. I think it must have been some stranger just passing through. Maybe someone who had a flat tire on that road after I went home. Maybe a burglar. Maybe a psychopath. He killed them, that's all. And I'm here. As simple as that. And he was condemned to spend the rest of his life in Shawshank, or the part of it that mattered. 5 years later, he began to have parole hearings, and he was turned down just as regular as clockwork in spite of being a model prisoner. Getting a pass out of Shawshank when you've got murder stamped on your admittance slip is slow work, as slow as a river eroding a rock. 7 men sit on the board, 2 more than at most state prisons, and every one of those 7 has an ass as hard as the water drawn up from a mineral spring well. You can't buy those guys. You can't sweet-talk them. You can't cry for them. As far as the board in here is concerned, money don't talk, and nobody walks. There were other reasons in Andy's case as well, but they belong a little further along in my story. There was a trustee, name of Kendrick,
Hicks, who was into me for some pretty heavy money back in the 50s, and it was 4 years before he got it all paid off. Most of the interest he paid me was information. In my line of work, you're dead if you can't find ways of keeping your ear to the ground. Miss Kendricks, for instance, had access to records I was never going to see running a stamper down in the goddamn plate shop. Kendricks told me that the parole board vote was 7-0 against Andy Dufresne through 1957, 6-1 in 58, 7-0 again in 59, and 5-2 in 60. After that, I don't know, but I do know that 16 years later he was still in cell 14 of cell block 5. By then, 1975, he was 57. They probably would have gotten big-hearted and let him out around 1983. They give you life, and that's what they take, all of it that counts anyway. Maybe they set you loose some day, but... Well, listen, I knew this guy, Sherwood Bolton, his name was, and he had this pigeon in his cell. From 1945 until 1953, when they let him out, he had that pigeon. He wasn't any birdman of Alcatraz, he just had this pigeon, Jake, he called him. He set Jake free a day before he, Sherwood, that is, was to walk, and Jake flew away just as pretty as you could want. But about a week after Sherwood Bolton left our happy little family, a friend of mine called me over to the west corner of the exercise yard where Sherwood used to hang out. A bird was lying there, like a very small pile of dirty bed linen. It looked starved. My friend said, "Isn't that Jake, Red?" It was. That pigeon was just as dead as a turd. I remember the first time Andy Dufresne got in touch with me for something. I remember it like it was yesterday. That wasn't the time he wanted Rita Hayworth, though. That came later. In the summer of 1948, he came around for something else. Most of my deals are done right there in the exercise yard, and that's where this one went down. Our yard is big, much bigger than most. It's a perfect square, 90 yards on a side. The north side is the outer wall with a guard tower at either end. The guards up there are armed with binoculars and riot guns. The main gate is in that north side. The truck loading bays are on the south side of the yard. There are 5 of them. Shawshank is a busy place during the work week. Deliveries in, deliveries out. We have the license plate factory and a big industrial laundry that does all the prison wet wash, plus that of Kittery Receiving Hospital and the Elliott Nursing Home. There's also a big automotive garage where mechanic inmates fix prison, state, and municipal vehicles. Not to mention the private cars of the screws, the administration offices, and on more than one occasion, those of the parole board. The east side is a thick stone wall full of tiny slit windows. Cell block 5 is on the other side of that wall. The west side is administration and the infirmary. Shawshank has never been as overcrowded as most prisons, and back in 48 it was only filled to something like 2/3 capacity. But at any given time, there might be 80 to 120 cons on the yard, playing toss with a football or baseball, shooting craps, jawing at each other, making deals. On Sunday, the place was even more crowded. On Sunday, the place would have looked like a country holiday, if there had been any women. It was on a Sunday that Andy first came to me. I had just finished talking to Elmore Armitage, a fellow who often came in handy to me, about a radio when Andy walked up. I knew who he was, of course. He had a reputation for being a snob and a cold fish. People were saying he was marked for trouble already. One of the people saying so was Boggs Diamond, a bad man to have on your case. Andy had no cellmate, and I'd heard that was just the way he wanted it, although people were already saying he thought his shit smelled sweeter than the ordinary. But I don't have to listen to rumors about a man when I can judge him for myself. "Hello," he said. "I'm Andy Dufresne." He offered his hand, and I shook it. He wasn't a man to waste time. Being social, he got right to the point. "I understand that you're a man who knows how to get things." I agreed that I was able to locate certain items from time to time. "How do you do that?" Andy asked. "Sometimes," I said, "things just seem to come into my hands. I can't explain it, unless it's because I'm Irish." He smiled a little at that. "I wonder if you could get me a rock hammer."
What would that be, and why would you want it? Andy looked surprised. Do you make motivations a part of your business? With words like those, I could understand how he had gotten a reputation for being the snobby sort, the kind of guy who likes to put on airs. But I sensed a tiny thread of humor in his question. I'll tell you, I said. If you wanted a toothbrush, I wouldn't ask questions. I'd just quote you a price, because a toothbrush, you see, is a non-lethal sort of an object. You have strong feelings about lethal objects? I do. An old friction-taped baseball flew toward us, and he turned cat-quick and picked it out of the air. It was a move Frank Malzoni would have been proud of. Andy flicked the ball back to where it had come from. Just a quick and easy-looking flick of the wrist, but that throw had some mustard on it just the same. I could see a lot of people were watching us with one eye as they went about their business. Probably the guards in the tower were watching, too. I won't gild the lily. There are cons that swing weight in any prison. Maybe four or five in a small one, maybe two or three dozen in a big one. At Shawshank, I was one of those with some weight. And what I thought of Andy Dufresne would have a lot to do with how his time went. He probably knew it, too, but he wasn't kowtowing or sucking up to me, and I respected him for that. Fair enough. I'll tell you what it is and why I want it. A rock hammer looks like a miniature pickaxe, about so long. He held his hands about a foot apart, and that's when I first noticed how neatly kept his nails were. It's got a small, sharp pick on one end and a flat, blunt hammerhead on the other. I want it because I like rocks. Rocks, I said. Squat down here a minute, he said. I humored him. We hunkered down on our haunches like Indians. Andy took a handful of exercise yard dirt and began to sift it between his neat hands, so it emerged in a fine cloud. Small pebbles were left over, one or two sparkly, the rest dull and plain. One of the dull ones was quartz, but it was only dull until you'd rubbed it clean. Then it had a nice, milky glow. Andy did the cleaning and then tossed it to me. I caught it and named it. Quartz, sure, he said. And look, mica, shale, silted granite. Here's a place of graded limestone from when they cut this place out of the side of the hill. He tossed them away and dusted his hands. I'm a rockhound. At least I was a rockhound in my old life. I'd like to be one again on a limited scale. Sunday expeditions in the exercise yard? I asked, standing up. It was a silly idea, and yet, seeing that little piece of quartz had given my heart a funny tweak. I don't know exactly why, just in association with the outside world, I suppose. You didn't think of such things in terms of the yard. Quartz was something you picked out of a small, quick-running stream. Better to have Sunday expeditions here than no Sunday expeditions at all, he said. You could plant an item like that rock hammer in somebody's skull, I remarked. I have no enemies here, he said quietly. No, I smiled. Wait a while. If there's trouble, I can handle it without using a rock hammer. Maybe you want to try and escape, going under the wall, because if you do... He laughed politely. When I saw the rock hammer 3 weeks later, I understood why. You know, I said, if anyone sees you with it, they'll take it away. If they saw you with a spoon, they'd take it away. What are you going to do, just sit down here in the yard and start banging away? Oh, I believe I can do a lot better than that. I nodded. That part of it really wasn't my business anyway. A man engages my services to get him something. Whether he can keep it or not after I get it is his business. How much would an item like that go for? I asked. I was beginning to enjoy his quiet, low-key style. When you've spent 10 years in stir, as I had then, you get awfully tired of the bellowers and the braggarts and the loudmouths. Yes, I think it would be fair to say I liked Andy from the first. $8 in any rock and gem shop, he said. But I realize that in a business like yours, you work on a cost-plus basis. Cost plus 10% is my going rate, but I have to go up some on a dangerous item. For something like the gadget you're talking about, it takes a little more goose grease to get the wheels turning. Let's say $10. $10 it is. I looked at him, smiling a little. Have you got $10? I do, he said quietly. A long time after, I discovered that he had better than 500. He had brought it in with him. When they check you in at this hotel, one of the bellhops is obliged to bend you over and take a look up your works. But there are a lot of works, and not to put too fine a point on it, a man who is really determined can get a fairly large item quite a ways up them, far enough to be out of sight, unless the bellhop you happen to draw is in the mood to pull on a rubber glove and go prospecting. That's fine, I said. You ought to know what I expect if you get caught with what I get you. I suppose I should, he said, and I could tell by the slight change in his gray eyes that he knew exactly what I was going to say. It was a slight lightning, a gleam of his special ironic humor. If you get caught, you'll say you found it. That's about the long and short of it. They'll put you in solitary for 3 or 4 weeks, plus, of course, you'll lose your toy, and you'll get a black mark on your record. If you give them my name, you and I will never do business again. Not for so much as a pair of shoelaces or a bag of bugler, and I'll send some fellows around to lump you up. I don't like violence, but you'll understand my position. I can't allow it to get around that I can't handle myself. That would surely finish me. Yes, I suppose it would. I understand, and you don't need to worry. I never worry, I said. In a place like this, there's no percentage in it. He nodded and walked away. 3 days later, he walked up beside me in the exercise yard during the laundry's morning break. He didn't speak or even look my way, but pressed a picture of the Honorable Alexander Hamilton into my hand as neatly as a good magician does a card trick. He was a man who adapted fast. I got him his rock hammer. I had it in my cell for one night, and it was just as he described it. It was no tool for escape. It would have taken a man about 600 years to tunnel under the wall using that rock hammer, I figured. But I still felt some misgivings. If you planted that pickaxe end in a man's head, he would surely never listen to Fibber McGee and Molly on the radio again. And Andy had already begun having trouble with the sisters. I hoped it wasn't them he was wanting the rock hammer for. In the end, I trusted my judgment. Early the next morning, 20 minutes before the wake-up horn went off, I slipped the rock hammer and a package of Camels to Ernie, the old trustee who swept the cell block 5 corridors until he was let free in 1956. He slipped it into his tunic without a word, and I didn't see the rock hammer again for 19 years, and by then it was damned near worn away to nothing. The following Sunday, Andy walked over to me in the exercise yard again. He was nothing to look at that day, I can tell you. His lower lip was swelled up so big it looked like a summer sausage. His right eye was swollen half shut, and there was an ugly washboard scrape across one cheek. He was having his troubles with the sisters, all right, but he never mentioned them. "Thanks for the tool," he said, and walked away. I watched him curiously. He walked a few steps, saw something in the dirt, bent over, and picked it up. It was a small rock. Prison fatigues, except for those worn by mechanics when they're on the job, have no pockets. But there are ways to get around that. The little pebble disappeared up Andy's sleeve and didn't come down. I admired that, and I admired him. In spite of the problems he was having, he was going on with his life. There are thousands who don't, or won't, or can't. And plenty of them aren't in prison, either. And I noticed that, although his face looked as if a twister had happened to it, his hands were still neat and clean, the nails well kept. I didn't see much of him over the next 6 months, and he spent a lot of that time in solitary. A few words about the sisters. In a lot of pens, they are known as Bull Queers or Jailhouse Susies. Just lately, the term in fashion is killer queens. But in Shawshank, they were always the sisters. I don't know why, but other than the name, I guess there was no difference. It comes as no surprise to most these days that there's a lot of buggery going on inside the walls. Except to some of the new fish, maybe, who have the misfortune to be young, slim, good-looking, and unwary. But homosexuality, like straight sex, comes in 100 different shapes and forms.
There are men who can't stand to be without sex of some kind and turn to another man to keep from going crazy. Usually what follows is an arrangement between two fundamentally heterosexual men, although I've sometimes wondered if they are quite as heterosexual as they thought they were going to be when they get back to their wives or their girlfriends. There are also men who get turned in prison. In the current parlance, they go gay or come out of the closet. Mostly, but not always, they play the female, and their favors are competed for fiercely. And then there are the sisters. They are to prison society what the rapist is to the society outside the walls. They're usually long-timers doing hard bullets for brutal crimes. Their prey is the young, the weak, and the inexperienced. Or, as in the case of Andy Dufresne, the weak-looking. Their hunting grounds are the showers, the cramped tunnel-like areaway behind the industrial washers and the laundry, sometimes the infirmary. On more than one occasion, rape has occurred in the closet-sized projection booth behind the auditorium. Most often, what the sisters take by force, they could have had for free if they wanted it that way. Those who have been turned always seem to have crushes on one sister or another, like teenage girls with their Sinatras, Presleys, or Redfords. But for the sisters, the joy has always been in taking it by force, and I guess it always will be. Because of his small size and fair good looks, and maybe also because of that very quality of self-possession I had admired, the sisters were after Andy from the day he walked in. If this was some kind of fairy story, I'd tell you that Andy fought the good fight until they left him alone. I wish I could say that, but I can't. Prison is no fairy tale world. The first time for him was in the shower less than 3 days after he joined our happy Shawshank family. Just a lot of slap and tickle that time, I understand. They like to size you up before they make their real move, like jackals finding out if the prey is as weak and hamstrung as it looks. Andy punched back and bloodied the lip of a big, hulking sister named Boggs Diamond. Gone these many years since, to who knows where. A guard broke it up before it could go any further, but Boggs promised to get him, and Boggs did. The second time was behind the washers and the laundry. A lot has gone on in that long, dusty, and narrow space over the years. The guards know about it and just let it be. It's dim and littered with bags of washing and bleaching compound, drums of hexlite catalyst, as harmless as salt if your hands are dry, murderous as battery acid if they're wet. The guards don't like to go back there. There's no room to maneuver, and one of the first things they teach them when they come to work in a place like this is to never let the cons get you in a place where you can't back up. Boggs wasn't there that day, but Henley Backus, who had been washroom foreman down there since 1922, told me that four of his friends were. Andy held them at bay for a while with a scoop of hexlite, threatening to throw it in their eyes if they came any closer. But he tripped, trying to back around one of the big Washex forepockets. That was all it took. They were on him. I guess the phrase gang rape is one that doesn't change much from one generation to the next. That's what they did to him, those four sisters. They bent him over a gearbox, and one of them held a Phillips screwdriver to his temple while they gave him the business. It rips you up some, but not bad. Am I speaking from personal experience, you ask? I only wish I weren't. You bleed for a while. If you don't want some clown asking you if you just started your period, you wad up a bunch of toilet paper and keep it down the back of your underwear until it stops. The bleeding really is like menstrual flow. It keeps up for 2, maybe 3 days, a slow trickle. Then it stops. No harm done, unless they've done something even more unnatural to you. No physical harm done. But rape is rape. And eventually you have to look at your face in the mirror again and decide what to make of yourself. Andy went through that alone, the way he went through everything alone in those days. He must have come to the conclusion that others before him had come to, namely, that there are only two ways to deal with the sisters. Fight them and get taken, or just get taken. He decided to fight. When Boggs and two of his buddies came after him a week or so after the laundry incident, "I heard you got broke in," Boggs said, according to Ernie, who was around at the time. Andy slugged it out with them. He broke the nose of a fellow named Rooster McBride, a heavy-gutted farmer who was in for beating his stepdaughter to death. Rooster died in here, I'm happy to add. They took him, all three of them. When it was done, Rooster and the other egg, it might have been Pete Verness, but I'm not completely sure, forced Andy down to his knees. Boggs Diamond stepped in front of him. He had a pearl-handled razor in those days with the words Diamond Pearl engraved on both sides of the grip. He opened it and said, "I'm going to open my fly now, Mr. Man, and you're going to swallow what I give you to swallow. And when you done swallowed mine, you're going to swallow Rooster's. I guess you done broke his nose, and I think he ought to have something to pay for it." Andy said, "Anything of yours that you stick in my mouth, you're going to lose it." Boggs looked at Andy like he was crazy, Ernie said. "No," he told Andy, talking to him slowly like Andy was a stupid kid. "You didn't understand what I said. You do anything like that, and I'll put all 8 inches of this steel into your ear. Get it?" "I understood what you said. I don't think you understood me. I'm going to bite whatever you stick into my mouth. You can put that razor into my brain, I guess, but you should know that a sudden serious brain injury causes the victim to simultaneously urinate, defecate, and bite down." He looked up at Boggs, smiling that little smile of his, old Ernie said, as if the three of them had been discussing stocks and bonds with him instead of throwing it to him as just as hard as they could. Just as if he was wearing one of his three-piece banker's suits instead of kneeling on a dirty broom closet floor with his pants around his ankles and blood trickling down the insides of his thighs. "In fact," he went on, "I understand that the bite reflex is sometimes so strong that the victim's jaws have to be pried open with a crowbar or a jack-handle." Boggs didn't put anything in Andy's mouth that night in late February of 1948, and neither did Rooster McBride. And so far as I know, no one else ever did either. What the three of them did was to beat Andy within an inch of his life, and all four of them ended up doing a jolt in solitary. Andy and Rooster McBride went by way of the infirmary. How many times did that particular crew have at him? I don't know. I think Rooster lost his taste fairly early on. Being in nose splints for a month can do that to a fellow. And Boggs Diamond left off that summer all at once. That was a strange thing. Boggs was found in his cell, badly beaten one morning in early June when he didn't show up in the breakfast nose count. He wouldn't say who had done it or how they had gotten to him, but being in my business, I know that a screw can be bribed to do almost anything, except get a gun for an inmate. They didn't make big salaries then, and they don't now. And in those days there was no electronic locking system, no closed-circuit TV, no master switches which controlled whole areas of the prison. Back in 1948, each cell block had its own turnkey. A guard could have been bribed real easy to let someone, maybe two or three someones, into the block, and yes, even into Diamond's cell. Of course, a job like that would have cost a lot of money. Not by outside standards, no. Prison economics are on a smaller scale. When you've been in here a while, a dollar bill in your hand looks like a 20 did outside. My guess is that if Boggs was done, it cost someone a serious piece of change. $15, we'll say, for the turnkey, and two or three apiece for each of the lump-up guys. I'm not saying it was Andy Dufresne, but I do know that he brought in $500 when he came, and he was a banker in the straight world, a man who understands better than the rest of us the ways in which money can become power. And I know this. After the beating, the three broken ribs, the hemorrhaged eye, the sprained back, and the dislocated hip, Boggs Diamond left Andy alone. In fact, after that he left everyone pretty much alone. He got to be like a high wind in the summertime, all bluster and no bite. You could say, in fact, that he turned into a weak sister. That was the end of Boggs Diamond, a man who might eventually have killed Andy if Andy hadn't taken steps to prevent it, if it was him who took the steps. But it wasn't the end of Andy's trouble with the sisters. There was a little hiatus, and then it began again, although not so hard or so often. Jackals like easy prey, and there were easier pickings around than Andy Dufresne. He always fought them. That's what I remember. He knew, I guess, that if you let them have at you even once without fighting, it got that much easier to let them have their way without fighting next time. So Andy would turn up with bruises on his face every once in a while. And there was the matter of the two broken fingers 6 or 8 months after Diamond's beating. Oh, yes, and sometime in late 1949, the man landed in the infirmary with a broken cheekbone that was probably the result of someone swinging a nice chunk of pipe with the business end wrapped in flannel. He always fought back, and as a result he did his time in solitary. But I don't think solitary was the hardship for Andy that it was for some men. He got along with himself. The sisters was something he adjusted himself to. And then, in 1950, it stopped almost completely. That is a part of my story that I'll get to in due time. In the fall of 1948, Andy met me one morning in the exercise yard and asked me if I could get him half a dozen rock blankets. "What the hell are those?" I asked. He told me that was just what rock hounds called them. They were polishing cloths about the size of dish towels. They were heavily padded with a smooth side and a rough side. The smooth side like fine-grained sandpaper, the rough side almost as abrasive as industrial steel wool. Andy also kept a box of that in his cell, although he didn't get it from me. I imagine he kited it from the prison laundry. I told him I thought we could do business on those, and I ended up getting them from the very same rock and gem shop where I had arranged to get the rock hammer. This time I charged Andy my usual 10%, and not a penny more. I didn't see anything lethal or even dangerous in a dozen 7-inch by 7-inch squares of padded cloth. Rock blankets, indeed. It was about 5 months later that Andy asked if I could get him Rita Hayworth. That conversation took place in the auditorium during a movie show. Nowadays we get the movie shows once or twice a week, but back then the shows were a monthly event. Usually the movies we got had a morally uplifting message to them, and this one, The Lost Weekend, was no different. The moral was that it's dangerous to drink. It was a moral we could take some comfort in. Andy maneuvered to get next to me, and about halfway through the show he leaned a little closer and asked if I could get him Rita Hayworth. I'll tell you the truth, it kind of tickled me. He was usually cool, calm, and collected, but that night he was jumpy as hell, almost embarrassed, as if he was asking me to get him a load of Trojans or one of those sheepskin-lined gadgets that are supposed to enhance your solitary pleasure, as the magazines put it. He seemed overcharged, a man on the verge of blowing his radiator. "I can get her," I said. "No sweat, calm down. You want the big one or the little one?" At that time, Rita was my best girl. A few years before, it had been Betty Grable. And she came in 2 sizes. For $1, you could get the little Rita. For $2.50, you could have the big Rita, 4 feet high and all woman. "The big one," he said, not looking at me. I tell you, he was a hot sketch that night. He was blushing just like a kid trying to get into a cooch show with his big brother's draft card. "Can you do it?" "Take it easy. Sure I can. There's a bear shit in the woods." The audience was applauding and catcalling as the bugs came out of the walls to get Ray Milland, who was having a bad case of the DTs. "How soon?" "A week, maybe less." "Okay." But he sounded disappointed, as if he had been hoping I had one stuffed down my pants right then. "How much?" I quoted him the wholesale price. I could afford to give him this one at cost. He'd been a good customer, what with his rock hammer and his rock blankets. Furthermore, he'd been a good boy, and more than one night, when he was having his problems with Boggs, Rooster, and the rest, I wondered how long it would be before he used the rock hammer to crack someone's head open. Posters are a big part of my business, just behind the booze and cigarettes, usually half a step ahead of the reefer. In the 60s, the business exploded in every direction, with a lot of people wanting funky hang-ups like Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, that Easy Rider poster. But mostly it's girls, one pin-up queen after another. A few days after Andy spoke to me, a laundry driver I did business with back then brought in better than 60 posters, most of them Rita Hayworth's. You may even remember the picture, I sure do. Rita is dressed, sort of, in a bathing suit, one hand behind her head, her eyes half closed, those full, sulky red lips parted. They called it Rita Hayworth, but they might as well have called it Woman in Heat. The prison administration knows about the black market, in case you were wondering. I'm sure they do. They probably know almost as much about my business as I do myself. They live with it because they know that a prison is like a big pressure cooker, and there have to be vents somewhere to let off some steam. They make the occasional bust, and I've done time in solitary a time or three over the years, but when it's something like posters, they wink. Live and let live. And when a big Rita Hayworth went up in some fishy's cell, the assumption was that it came in the mail from a friend or relative. Of course, all the care packages from friends and relatives are opened and the contents inventoried, but who goes back and rechecks the inventory sheets for something as harmless as a Rita Hayworth or an Ava Gardner pinup? When you're in a pressure cooker, you learn to live and let live, or somebody will carve you a brand new mouth just above the Adam's apple. You learn to make allowances. It was Ernie again who took the poster up to Andy's cell, 14, from my own, 6, and it was Ernie who brought back the note written in Andy's careful hand. Just one word, thanks. A little while later, as they filed us out for morning chow, I glanced into his cell and saw Rita over his bunk in all her swimsuited glory, one hand behind her head, her eyes half closed, those soft, satiny lips parted. It was over his bunk where he could look at her nights after lights out in the glow of the arc sodiums in the exercise yard. But in the bright morning sunlight, there were dark slashes across her face, the shadow of the bars on his single-slit window. Now I'm going to tell you what happened in mid-May of 1950 that finally ended Andy's 3-year series of skirmishes with the sisters. It was also the incident which eventually got him out of the laundry and into the library, where he filled out his work time until he left our happy little family earlier this year. You may have noticed how much of what I've told you already is hearsay. Someone saw something and told me, and I told you. Well, in some cases I've simplified it even more than it really was, and have repeated, or will repeat, fourth or fifth-hand information. That's the way it is here. The grapevine is very real, and you have to use it if you're going to stay ahead. Also, of course, you have to know how to pick out the grains of truth from the chaff of lies, rumors, and wish-it-had-beens. You may also have gotten the idea that I'm describing someone who's more legend than man, and I would have to agree that there's some truth to that. To us long-timers who knew Andy over a space of years, there was an element of fantasy to him, a sense almost of myth-magic, if you get what I mean. That story I passed on about Andy refusing to give Boggs Diamond a head job is part of that myth, and how he kept on fighting the sisters is part of it, and how he got the library job is part of it, too. But with one important difference. I was there, and I saw what happened, and I swear on my mother's name that it's all true. The oath of a convicted murderer may not be worth much, but believe this, I don't lie. Andy and I were on fair speaking terms by then. The guy fascinated me. Looking back to the poster episode, I see there's one thing I neglected to tell you, and maybe I should. 5 weeks after he hung Rita up, I'd forgotten all about it by then and had gone on to other deals, Ernie passed a small white box through the bars of my cell. "From Dufresne," he said, low, and never missed a stroke with his push-broom. "Thanks, Ernie," I said, and slipped him half a pack of Camels. Now, what the hell was this, I was wondering, as I slipped the cover from the box. There was a lot of white cotton inside, and below that, I looked for a long time. For a few minutes it was like I didn't even dare touch them. They were so pretty. There's a crying shortage of pretty things in the slam, and the real pity of it is that a lot of men don't even seem to miss them. There were two pieces of quartz in that box, both of them carefully polished. They had been chipped into driftwood shapes. There were little sparkles of iron pyrites in them, like flecks of gold. If they hadn't been so heavy, they would have served as a fine pair of men's cufflinks. They were that close to being a matched set. How much work went into creating those two pieces? Hours and hours after lights out, I knew that. First the chipping and shaping, and then the almost endless polishing and finishing with those rock blankets. Looking at them, I felt the warmth that any man or woman feels when he or she is looking at something pretty, something that has been worked and made. That's the thing that really separates us from the animals, I think. And I felt something else, too, a sense of awe for the man's brute persistence. But I never knew just how persistent Andy Dufresne could be until much later. In May of 1950, the powers that be decided that the roof of the license plate factory ought to be resurfaced with roofing tar. They wanted it done before it got too hot up there, and they asked for volunteers to do the work, which was planned to take about a week. More than 70 men spoke up because it was outside work, and May is one damn fine month for outside work. 9 or 10 names were drawn out of a hat, and 2 of them happened to be Andy's and my own. For the next week, we'd be marched out to the exercise yard after breakfast, with 2 guards up front and 2 more behind, plus all the guards in the towers keeping a weather eye on the proceedings through their field glasses for good measure. 4 of us would be carrying a big extension ladder on these morning marches. I always got a kick out of the way Dickie Betts, who was on that job, called that sort of ladder an extensible, and we'd put it up against the side of that low, flat building. Then we'd start bucket brigading hot buckets of tar up to the roof. Spill that shit on you and you'd jitterbug all the way to the infirmary. There were 6 guards on the project, all of them picked on the basis of seniority. It was almost as good as a week's vacation, because instead of sweating it out in the laundry or the plate shop or standing over a bunch of cons cutting pulp or brush somewhere out in the willy-wags, they were having a regular May holiday in the sun, just sitting there with their backs up against the low parapet, shooting the bull back and forth. They didn't even have to keep more than half an eye on us because the south wall sentry post was close enough so that the fellows up there could have spit their chews on us if they'd wanted to. If anyone on the roof ceiling party had made one funny move, it would take 4 seconds to cut him smack in 2 with 45 caliber machine gun bullets. So those screws just sat there and took their ease. All they needed was a couple of 6-packs buried in crushed ice, and they would have been the lords of all creation. One of them was a fellow named Byron Hadley, and in that year of 1950 he'd been at Shawshank longer than I had, longer than the last 2 wardens put together, as a matter of fact. The fellow running the show in 1950 was a prissy-looking down-east Yankee named George Dunahy. He had a degree in penal administration. No one liked him, as far as I could tell, except the people who had gotten him his appointment. I heard that he was only interested in 3 things: compiling statistics for a book, which was later published by a small New England outfit called Lightside Press, where he probably had to pay to have it done; which team won the intramural baseball championship each September; and getting a death penalty law passed in Maine. A regular bear for the death penalty was George Dunahy. He was fired off the job in 1953 when it came out he was running a discount auto repair service down in the prison garage and splitting the profits with Byron Hadley and Greg Stammers. Hadley and Stammers came out of that one okay. They were old hands at keeping their asses covered. But Dunahy took a walk. No one was sorry to see him go, but nobody was exactly pleased to see Greg Stamos step into his shoes either. He was a short man with a tight, hard gut and the coldest brown eyes you ever saw. He always had a painful, pursed little grin on his face, as if he had to go to the bathroom and couldn't quite manage it. During Stamos's tenure as warden, there was a lot of brutality at Shawshank, and although I have no proof, I believe there were maybe half a dozen moonlight burials in the stand of scrub forest that lies east of the prison. Dunahy was bad, but Greg Stamos was a cruel, wretched, cold-hearted man. He and Byron Hadley were good friends. As warden, George Dunahy was nothing but a posturing figurehead. It was Stamos, and through him Hadley, who actually administered the prison. Hadley was a tall, shambling man with thinning red hair. He sunburned easily, and he talked loud, and if you didn't move fast enough to shoot him, he'd clout you with his stick. On that day, our third on the roof, he was talking to another guard named Mert Entwistle. Hadley had gotten some amazingly good news, so he was griping about it. That was his style. He was a thankless man with not a good word for anyone, a man who was convinced that the whole world was against him. The world had cheated him out of the best years of his life, and the world would be more than happy to cheat him out of the rest. I have seen some screws that I thought were almost saintly, and I think I know why that happens. They are able to see the difference between their own lives, poor and struggling as they might be, and the lives of the men they are paid by the state to watch over. These guards are able to formulate a comparison concerning pain. Others can't, or won't. For Byron Hadley there was no basis of comparison. He could sit there, cool and at his ease under the warm May sun, and find the gall to mourn his own good luck, while less than 10 feet away a bunch of men were working and sweating and burning their hands on great big buckets filled with bubbling tar, men who had to work so hard in their ordinary round of days that this looked like a respite. You may remember the old question, the one that's supposed to define your outlook on life when you answer it. For Byron Hadley, the answer would always be half empty. The glass is half empty, forever and ever, amen. If you gave him a cool drink of apple cider, he'd think about vinegar. If you told him his wife had always been faithful to him, he'd tell you it was because she was so damn ugly. So there he sat, talking to Mert Entwistle loud enough for all of us to hear, his broad white forehead already starting to redden with the sun. He had one hand thrown back over the low parapet surrounding the roof. The other was on the butt of his .38. We all got the story. Along with Mert, it seemed that Hadley's older brother had gone off to Texas some 14 years ago, and the rest of the family hadn't heard from the son of a bitch since. They had all assumed he was dead, and good riddance. Then, a week and a half ago, a lawyer had called them long distance from Austin. It seemed that Hadley's brother had died 4 months ago, and a rich man at that. It's frigging incredible how lucky some assholes can get, this paragon of gratitude on the plate shop roof said. The money had come as a result of oil and oil leases, and there was close to $1 million. No, Hadley wasn't a millionaire. That might have made him even happy, at least for a while. But the brother had left a pretty damn decent bequest of $35,000 to each surviving member of his family back in Maine, if they could be found. Not bad. Like getting lucky and winning a sweepstakes. But to Byron Hadley, the glass was always half empty. He spent most of the morning bitching to Mert about the bite that the goddamn government was going to take out of his windfall. "They'll leave me about enough to buy a new car with," he allowed. "And then what happens? You have to pay the damn taxes on the car and the repairs and maintenance. You got your goddamn kids pestering you to take 'em for a ride with the top down." "And to drive it if they're old enough," Mert said. Old Mert Entwistle knew which side his bread was buttered on, and he didn't say what must have been as obvious to him as to the rest of us. "If that money's worrying you so bad, Byron, old kid, old sock, I'll just take it off your hands. After all, what are friends for?" "That's right. "'Wanting to drive it, wanting to learn to drive on it, for Christ's sake,' Byron said with a shudder. "'Then what happens at the end of the year? "'If you figured the tax wrong and you don't have enough left over to pay the overdraft, "'you got to pay out of your own pocket or maybe even borrow it from one of those kikey loan agencies. "'And they audit you anyway, you know, it don't matter. "'And when the government audits you, they always take more. "'Who can fight Uncle Sam?' He puts his hand inside your shirt and squeezes your tit until it's purple and you end up getting the short end. Christ! He lapsed into a morose silence, thinking of what terrible bad luck he'd had to inherit that $35,000. Andy Dufresne had been spreading tar with a big pad brush less than 15 feet away, and now he tossed it into his pail and walked over to where Mert and Hadley were sitting. We all tightened up. "'And I saw one of the other screws, Tim Youngblood, "'drag his hand down to where his pistol was holstered. "'One of the fellows in the sentry tower struck his partner on the arm, "'and they both turned too. "'For one moment I thought Andy was going to get shot or clubbed or both. "'Then he said very softly to Hadley, "'Do you trust your wife?' "'Hadley just stared at him. "'He was starting to get red in the face, and I knew that was a bad sign.' In about 3 seconds he was going to pull his billy and give Andy the butt end of it right in the solar plexus where that big bundle of nerves is. A hard enough hit there can kill you, but they always go for it. If it doesn't kill you, it'll paralyze you long enough to forget whatever cute move it was that you had planned. "Boy," Hadley said, "I'll give you just one chance to pick up that pad, and then you're going off this roof on your head." Andy just looked at him, very calm and still. His eyes were like ice. It was as if he hadn't heard. And I found myself wanting to tell him how it was, to give him the crash course. The crash course is you never let on that you hear the guards talking. You never try to horn in on their conversation unless you're asked, and then you always tell them just what they want to hear and shut up again. Black man, white man, red man, yellow man, in prison it doesn't matter, because we've got our own brand of equality. In prison every con's a nigger, and you have to get used to the idea if you intend to survive men like Hadley and Greg Stamos, who really would kill you as soon as look at you. When you're in stir, you belong to the state, and if you forget it, woe is you. I've known men who've lost eyes, men who've lost toes and fingers. I knew one man who lost the tip of his penis and counted himself lucky that was all he lost. I wanted to tell Andy that it was already too late. He could go back and pick up his brush, and there would still be some big lug waiting for him in the showers that night, ready to Charlie horse both of his legs and leave him writhing on the cement. You could buy a lug like that for a pack of cigarettes or 3 Baby Ruths. Most of all, I wanted to tell him not to make it any worse than it already was. What I did was to keep on running tar out onto the roof as if nothing at all was happening. Like everyone else, I look after my own ass first. I have to. It's cracked already. And in Shawshank there have always been Hadleys willing to finish the job of breaking it. Andy said, "Maybe I put it wrong." Whether you trust her or not is immaterial. The problem is whether or not you believe she would ever go behind your back, try to hamstring you. Hadley got up. Mert got up. Tim Youngblood got up. Hadley's face was as red as the side of a fire barn. "Your only problem," he said, "is going to be how many bones you still got unbroken. You can count them in the infirmary. Come on, Mert, we're throwing this sucker over the side." Tim Youngblood drew his gun. The rest of us kept tarring like mad. The sun beat down. They were going to do it. Hadley and Mert were simply going to pitch him over the side. Terrible accident. Dufresne, prisoner 81433-SHNK, was taking a couple of empties down and slipped on the ladder. Too bad. They laid hold of him. Mert on the right arm, Hadley on the left. Andy didn't resist. His eyes never left Hadley's red, horsey face. "If you've got your thumb on her, Mr. Hadley," he said in that same calm, composed voice, "there's not a reason why you shouldn't have every cent of that money. Final score, Mr. Byron Hadley, 35,000, Uncle Sam zip." Mert started to drag him toward the edge. Hadley just stood there. For a moment, Andy was like a rope between them in a tug-of-war game. Then Hadley said, "Hold on 1 second, Mert. What do you mean, boy?" I mean, if you've got your thumb on your wife, you can give it to her, Andy said. You better start making sense, boy, or you're going over. The IRS allows you a one-time-only gift to your spouse, Andy said. It's good up to $60,000. Hadley was now looking at Andy as if he had been pole-axed. "Naw, that ain't right," he said. "Tax-free?" "Tax-free," Andy said. "IRS can't touch 1 cent." "How would you know a thing like that?" Tim Youngblood said, "He used to be a banker, Byron. I suppose he might..." "Shut your head, Trout," Hadley said, without looking at him. Tim Youngblood flushed and shut up. Some of the guards called him Trout because of his thick lips and buggy eyes. Hadley kept looking at Andy. "You're the smart banker who shot his wife. Why should I believe a smart banker like you? So I can wind up in here breaking rocks right alongside you? You'd like that, wouldn't you?" Andy said quietly, "If you went to jail for tax evasion, you'd go to a federal penitentiary, not Shawshank. But you won't. The tax-free gift to the spouse is a perfectly legal loophole. I've done dozens, no, hundreds of them. It's meant primarily for people with small businesses to pass on, for people who come into one-time-only windfalls, like yourself." "I think you're lying," Hadley said, but he didn't. You could see he didn't. There was an emotion dawning on his face, something that was grotesque, overlying that long, ugly countenance and that receding, sunburned brow. An almost obscene emotion when seen on the features of Byron Hadley. It was hope. "No, I'm not lying. There's no reason why you should take my word for it either. Engage a lawyer, ambulance-chasing, highway-robbing cocksuckers," Hadley cried. Andy shrugged. "Then go to the IRS. They'll tell you the same thing for free. Actually, you don't need me to tell you at all. You could have investigated the matter for yourself." "You're fucking A. I don't need any smart, wife-killing banker to show me where the bear shit in the buckwheat." "You'll need a tax lawyer or a banker to set up the gift for you, and that'll cost you something," Andy said. "Or, if you are interested, I'd be glad to set it up for you, nearly free of charge. The price would be 3 beers apiece for my co-workers." "Co-workers," Mert said, and let out a rusty guffaw. He slapped his knee. A real knee-slapper was old Mert, and I hope he died of intestinal cancer in a part of the world where morphine is as of yet undiscovered. "Co-workers, ain't that cute? Co-workers, you ain't got any..." "Shut your friggin' trap," Hadley growled, and Mert shut. Hadley looked at Andy again. "What was you saying?" "I was saying that I'd only ask 3 beers apiece for my co-workers, if that seems fair," Andy said. "I think a man feels more like a man when he's working out of doors in the springtime if he can have a bottle of suds. That's only my opinion. It would go down smooth, and I'm sure you'd have their gratitude." "I have talked to some of the other men who were up there that day. Rennie Martin, Logan St. Pierre, and Paul Bonsant were 3 of them, and we all saw the same thing then, felt the same thing. Suddenly it was Andy who had the upper hand. It was Hadley who had the gun on his hip, and the billy in his hand. Hadley who had his friend Greg Stamos behind him, and the whole prison administration behind Stamos, the whole power of the state behind that. But all at once, in that golden sunshine, it didn't matter. And I felt my heart leap up in my chest as it never had since the truck drove me and 4 others through the gate back in 1938 and I stepped out onto the exercise yard." Andy was looking at Hadley with those cold, clear, calm eyes. And it wasn't just the $35,000 then, we all agreed on that. I've played it over and over in my mind, and I know it was man against man. And Andy simply forced him, the way a strong man can force a weaker man's wrist to the table in a game of Indian wrestling. There was no reason, you see, why Hadley couldn't have given Mert the nod at that very minute, pitched Andy overside onto his head, and still taken Andy's advice. No reason. But he didn't. "I could get you all a couple of beers if I wanted to," Hadley said. "A beer does taste good while you're working." The colossal prick even managed to sound magnanimous. "I'd just give you 1 piece of advice the IRS wouldn't bother with," Andy said. His eyes were fixed unwinkingly on Hadley's. Make this gift to your wife if you're sure. If you think there's even a chance she might double-cross you or backshoot you, we could work out something else.
Double-cross me? Hadley asked harshly. Double-cross me? Mr. Hotshot Banker, if she ate her way through a boxcar of Ex-Lax, she wouldn't dare fart unless I gave her the nod.
Mert, Youngblood, and the other screws yucked it up dutifully. Andy never cracked a smile.
I'll write down the forms you need, he said. You can get them at the post office, and I'll fill them out for your signature.
That sounded suitably important, and Hadley's chest swelled. Then he glared around at the rest of us and hollered, "What are you Jimmies staring at? Move your asses, goddammit!" He looked back at Andy. "You come over here with me, Hotshot, and listen to me well. If you're Jewing me somehow, you're going to find yourself chasing your own head around Shower Sea before the week's out."
"Yes, I understand that," Andy said softly. And he did understand it. The way it turned out, he understood a lot more than I did. More than any of us did.
That's how, on the second-to-last day of the job, the convict crew that tarred the plate factory roof in 1950 ended up sitting in a row at 10 o'clock on a spring morning, drinking black-label beer supplied by the hardest screw that ever walked a turn at Shawshank State Prison. That beer was piss-warm, but it was still the best I ever had in my life. We sat and drank it and felt the sun on our shoulders, and not even the expression of half-amusement, half-contempt on Hadley's face, as if he were watching apes drink beer instead of men, could spoil it. It lasted 20 minutes, that beer break, and for those 20 minutes we felt like free men. We could have been drinking beer and tarring the roof of one of our own houses. Only Andy didn't drink. I already told you about his drinking habit. He sat hunkered down in the shade, hands dangling between his knees, watching us and smiling a little. It's amazing how many men remember him that way, and amazing how many men were on that work crew when Andy Dufresne faced down Byron Hadley. I thought there were 9 or 10 of us, but by 1955 there must have been 200 of us. Maybe more, if you believed what you heard. So, yeah, if you ask me to give you a flat-out answer to the question of whether I'm trying to tell you about a man or a legend that got made up around the man, like a pearl around a little piece of grit, I'd have to say that the answer lies somewhere in between. All I know for sure is that Andy Dufresne wasn't much like me or anyone else I ever knew since I came inside. He brought in $500 jammed up his back porch, but somehow that gray-meat son of a bitch managed to bring in something else as well. A sense of his own worth, maybe, or a feeling that he could be the winner in the end. Or maybe it was only a sense of freedom, even inside these goddamned gray walls. It was a kind of inner light he carried around with him. I only knew him to lose that light once, and that is also a part of this story.